Face the Nation, coming up next.
Squarespace makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. It's the all-in-one platform that really is easy to use. Building a website is as easy as drag and drop. You can use drag and drop to add content from your desktop and even rearrange elements of content within a page. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code FACETHENATION. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look great on every device every time. It starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. You can also use Squarespace to easily connect your new website to Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and many more web and social services. For the best way to build your own site quickly, go to squarespace.com, use offer code FACETHENATION. That's offer code FACETHENATION.
And now from CBS News in Washington, Face the Nation. Substituting for Bob Schieffer, CBS This Morning co-host Charlie Rose.
Today on Face the Nation, breaking news this morning as the search for missing Malaysian Air Flight 370 continues and Russia's grip on Crimea tightens. Recovery efforts off the coast of Vietnam and Malaysia continue after Malaysian airliner carrying 239 people, including three Americans, vanishes. We'll have the latest on that story. Then, as Russia moves more troops into Crimea, international diplomatic efforts make little progress. We'll talk to former Vice President Dick Cheney and former Secretary of State Jim Baker about the crisis and what, if anything, the U.S. can do. Plus, we'll hear from former Obama National Security Advisor General Jim Jones. And as conservatives meet in Washington, we'll check in with former Vice President candidate Paul Ryan about the future of the Republican Party. We'll also have analysis from a panel of experts. 60 years of news, because this is Face the Nation. Welcome to Face the Nation. I'm Charlie Rose, sitting in for Bob Schieffer. We are watching two big stories this morning. First, as recovery teams search the waters between Malaysia and Vietnam for the missing Boeing 777 that disappeared from the radar early Saturday morning, there are new questions about some of the passengers on that plane. We start with CBS News correspondent Seth Doan in Beijing. Seth, what's the latest?
Good morning to you, Charlie. The search for Flight 370 has widened to include 22 aircraft and 40 ships from 11 different countries, including the United States. People from the NTSB and the FAA have also been sent in to assist with the investigation. Today in Malaysia, authorities there said that they were reviewing radar images that seemed to indicate that the plane may have turned back just before it lost contact with controllers. There they are also looking closely at security camera footage from inside Kuala Lumpur Airport, specifically focusing on two passengers who were traveling on stolen passports. Two-thirds of the passengers on board this plane are Chinese, and family members here in Beijing have been taken to a local hotel where Malaysia Airlines is offering what little comfort, what little information they can. Though today, the airline did tell those waiting family members that they should begin to prepare for the worst. Charlie?
Thank you, Seth. Join us now, CBS News Justice and Homeland Security correspondent Bob Orr, who's also spent many years on the transportation beat here at CBS. So the question everybody's asking, how could a plane simply vanish?
Very rare, Charlie. A plane at cruise altitude is in its safest phase of flight. It almost never happens, but it does happen. In June of 2009, there was a very famous case, Air France 447, coming out of Brazil, en route to Paris. It gets over the South Atlantic, and it just vanishes. And it took us months to find any of the wreckage.
But is there normally some kind of distress call?
Yes, and that's what has people so concerned right now. At 35,000 feet, you would think that the pilots have time to say, hey, we're in trouble here, and to give some hint as to what system might be failing, if that's what they're up against, or what event has happened on the airplane. But I have to tell you, it's not completely uncommon for pilots to get so focused on the problem at hand that they don't have time to notify anybody. They're taught, and it's drilled into their heads, fly the plane first. Diagnose the problem, fly the plane first, and then tell others about your problem.
And so what do we know about the passport cases of two people who seem to have purchased their tickets at the same time using false passports.
Well, we know this is a failure of the screening system there in Malaysia to start with, because there's no way that two people with stolen passports should be allowed on that airplane. Interpol had reported these as stolen passports. Those numbers were posted. That should have been stopped. That said, we don't know what these people were up to. Were they just traveling for some criminal enterprise? Were they traveling to seek refuge in some other country? Were they part of some kind of scheme? Or were they terrorists? And this is why the intel folks in this country and in Great Britain and around the world really are going through all the facts that we know, and there aren't very many at this point, Charlie, trying to figure out, was this a terror event? And if it was a terror event, what role, if any, did these two people play? And were they the only people on the plane?
So if there were two passports that were fake, there may be more.
Well, that's a possibility. In fact, the numbers have been all over the place. We heard there might be four suspicious passengers. Mm-hmm. The Malaysian authorities have been a little bit fuzzy on the details. Mm-hmm.
Is now the suspicion moving towards terrorism?
I wouldn't say that. I would say that that's one of a couple of things that happened. Whatever happened, happened quickly, and it was a cataclysmic failure at high altitude. There's a couple of possibilities here. Either you had a systems failure, compounded perhaps by pilot errors in responding to the first failure. That's what we call a cascading series of failures. Or maybe there was an event. Maybe there was terrorism. A small bomb like Lockerbie, for example, punches a hole in the plane, and at that altitude, the plane is ripped apart. But when the wreckage is recovered and when we find the black boxes, that data and those forensic pieces of evidence will give us a lot more.
And if there's a mid-air explosion, generally there's a trail of debris.
Yes, and if the plane broke up at a very high altitude, I would expect that trail of debris to be over 100 miles, maybe more. So that's a big clue. If we find the plane and it's relatively localized, that will tell us the plane likely hit the water intact.
Bob Orr, thank you.
Thank you.
There's also news overnight in Ukraine. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk announced today he'll visit the U.S. this week. This as more Russian troops moved into Crimea. The Russian government is also threatening to suspend international inspections of their nuclear weapons after the U.S. imposed sanctions late last week. Former Vice President Dick Cheney joins us now. Good morning.
Morning, Charlie.
Tell me what our options are today.
Well, I think I worry when we begin to address a crisis by the first thing we do is take options off the table. I don't think the administration should do that.
Have they done that?
In the sense of saying that no military. He seems to operate that way most of the time. There are military options that don't involve putting troops on the ground in Crimea. We could go back and reinstate the ballistic missile defense program that was taken out. It was originally going to go in Poland, Czech Republic. Obama took it out to appease Putin. We could do training exercises in Poland, joint exercises. We can offer military assistance in terms of equipment, training, and so forth to the Ukrainians themselves. So
there's some activation of military forces, are there not?
But some activation?
In terms of having forces come and make their appearance there.
On our part?
Yes.
I'm not aware of any detail. NATO, I'm sure NATO will think about it.
Right.
It's very important to NATO. A lot of the NATO members were part of the old Soviet Empire, Warsaw Pact, the Baltic states, Poland, Hungary, and so forth. And they are very worried when they see Putin absolutely ride roughshod over solemn commitments he made and that the government of Russia made, like the Budapest Memorandum, when Russia, the U.S., and Britain guaranteed the borders of Ukraine in return for Ukraine giving up their nuclear weapons. Very important, and Putin has just blown that off. He's gone right through it, and people begin to wonder, is his word ever good for anything?
So that's the question. Do you believe that President Putin believes that President Obama is weak and will pass through his red lines, and therefore he should be tested?
No, I don't know whether he believes he should be tested. I think there's no question but he believes he is weak. He has seen the so-called reset policy that's led to giving up on the ballistic missile defenses, for example. We have created an image around the world, not just for the Russians, of weakness and indecisiveness. The Syrian situation is a classic. We got all ready to do something. But a lot of the allies signed on at the last minute. Obama backed off.
But don't you think that the president is trying to do and take all the diplomatic steps that he can take now?
I think he is, but I also think he hasn't got any credibility with our allies. I just happened to speak to a couple of members of European Parliament within the last couple of days who indicated that, you know, the request for the Europeans to cooperate on sanctions is more difficult than it would have been because of what happened with respect to Syria, that in fact they got ready to go, and at the last minute, the U.S. President Obama backed off. So he's got a much higher mountain to climb in order to try to mobilize European governments to come on board for something other than military action.
Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, for both President Obama and President Bush, said today, "I do not believe that Crimea will slip out of Russia's hands," suggesting that the Russian troops will not leave and that there will be a different situation on the ground in Crimea.
That's very possible. But I don't.
Can we stand that in your judgment?
In my judgment, we have to recognize the fact that this is an egregious violation, if you will, of treaty commitments, a solemn obligation on the part of the Russian government to recognize the boundaries of the newly independent states of the old Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. And that was one of the most significant developments in the 20th century, and Putin is simply ignoring all of those commitments. I don't think he should be able to do that without paying a price.
But as you know, in Georgia, the people will make the case that Russian troops remained and that it was a very different situation because we did not or were not able to respond more.
Right.
So that's what is true. That lesson of that?
Well, the lesson
in
of
your
that,
own
I
administration.
Think, the lesson of that, I think, it came at a time sort of at the end of the Bush administration, the beginning of the Obama administration. But it was a deep concern to our friends in Western Europe. We did take some steps in terms of providing assistance to Georgia. We had ships in the region and so forth. So there were steps taken, but they weren't effective in terms of driving Putin out. Part of the problem in that case, there was a question about who actually provoked whom with respect to the Georgians.
Do you believe sanctions will be enough?
I don't know. I don't have any way to evaluate
that. And if they are not,
I think they ought to be.
I mean, you know, how much of a confrontation does the United States want to engage in on the ground?
How much? The real question is how much do you want to allow Putin to ignore those agreements, very, very important agreements that ended the Cold War, led to the reunification of Europe and the liberation of millions of people from under the boot heel, if you will, of the Soviet Union. That was one of the most significant events of the 20th century, and now he's starting to chip away at that. He's trying to reverse those developments very clearly with respect to Crimea, and I do not believe that we should allow him to do that without paying
price. But the question then is, you do not believe we should allow him, what are we prepared to do to stop him?
Well, that's the key question.
But what's your answer, then?
And my answer is reinstate the ballistic missile defense program in Poland. He cares a lot about that. Conduct joint military exercises with our NATO friends close to the Russian border. Offer up equipment and training to the Ukrainian military. Take steps that will guarantee and convey the notion, especially to our friends in Europe, that we keep our commitments. So far, that's in doubt. And I think it's much a matter of sending a strong signal that the U.S. will keep its commitments to our friends and allies. That's been in doubt for some time now because of the policies of the Obama administration. And this becomes a crucial moment.
So you think those nations, those Baltic nations, should be nervous as to whether NATO and their members of the NATO alliance will come to their defense?
Yeah. We have a treaty obligation under Article 5 of the NATO treaty. To attack against ones and attack against all. And we absolutely, I think, will find, if you go to Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia today, that our friends there recognize they've got Russian minority populations inside. They were under the control of the old Soviet Union for decades, and now they're free and independent states, but they depend upon the United States for leadership and guaranteeing their
security. So what happened if the Crimeans say, we want to join Russia?
I don't know. We'll have to see what happens to that. Obviously, there's an argument about whether or not they can do that, given among other things, the Budapest Memorandum of 1994.
And, of course, the Russians say that there was an unconstitutional coup in Kiev.
Right. So there's a debate, obviously, underway, and I don't know how it's going to unfold. But I think Putin is – I think he's got domestic problems at home. I don't think that this is a situation where – there aren't vulnerabilities from the standpoint of the
But
Russian
there's also
culture.
The energy weapon, too. I mean, can we, in a sense, provide the money and the energy to the people in Ukraine so that, therefore, they'll feel less pressure from Russia?
But energy is also a weakness for Russia. They depend on energy, on petroleum, for 50% of their GDP. If the price of oil drops a few dollars, they go into recession. it accounts for most of the budget in the Russian government. So for him to be again talking about cutting off sales, that's a two-edged sword. It does not necessarily mean that it's going to create a bigger problem for the customer than it does for the supplier.
We could be looking at a new Cold War.
Well, I don't know that it'll go that far, but I think there should be no doubt in anybody's mind that the United States is going to do everything we can to mobilize NATO, our Western European friends and allies, to make certain that Putin gets the message that this kind of behavior is unacceptable and won't tolerate it, and he can't do it without paying a price.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President.
Yes, sir, Charlie.
Good to see you. Join us now from Sea Island, Georgia this morning, Republican Congressman Paul Ryan. Good morning, Congressman.
Morning, Charlie. How are you doing?
You heard what the Vice President said. Do you agree with him?
I do. I think we should definitely revisit missile defense. I think if President Obama himself revisited missile defense, that would be a very strong signal. I think you could charitably describe the reset policy as naive, wishful thinking. And there are a lot of things I think we could do to turn course and make a difference in this. And I think the Vice President laid out some good options. We should also bolster NATO's eastern defenses as well.
Do you believe sanctions will work? I mean, do you think that this Russian president is so intent in terms of trying to restore Russian influence that sanctions will not be impressive to him?
Well, my crystal ball is no clearer than yours is, Charlie, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't give this every ounce of effort. I don't know if that's going to work. I think Putin is, as you describe, but I do think there are vulnerabilities within Russia that he has politically that can be exploited. I think we should consider targeting some of the oligarchs around him that are his enablers, and he is their enablers. I think
how would
we
you
are
target
a country
them?
With
how
vast...
How would you target them?
Well, I think you target their ability to travel. You target their international reserves. You target their holdings overseas that are illicitly gained through this kleptocracy of the Russian economy. One more point I'd say. We are a nation with vast energy reserves and potential, but with a government that is seen as hostile toward developing those energy reserves, let alone exporting those energy reserves. If our government changed its tune on that, if we told Europe we are going to green light these languishing permit applications for exporting LNG, natural gas, to Europe, that could do a lot to send the signals that we are intent on loosening Russia's grip on its energy to Europe, and that we're going to be a reliable ally to loosen their grip. They get their money from petrol. About half their budget comes from energy. If we could compromise that by developing American energy, creating jobs here, lowering prices, I think that would be a huge step in the right direction. We're going to move on that in the House, and I think the president would have a great opportunity. Change tune, resets failed, missile defense, smart sanctions, energy.
Let me move to CPAC, and you were one of the speakers. You said there needs to be a vigorous debate, and it's taking place. Whatever happened to bipartisanship in foreign policy?
Well, we used to have it. When we had Scoop Jackson Democrats, when we had Cherry Truman Democrats, when we had Kennedy Democrats, President Kennedy Democrats, we had bipartisan foreign policy. This is not that kind of an administration. This is a far more progressive left administration that I think is uncomfortable with America's superpower responsibilities and status, hegemony. And so I don't think that's what you have with this administration. I think it's a coincidence, but the irony is very bitter. The week that Vladimir Putin invades Russia, the president brings a budget to Congress cutting our military deeply. So I just don't think you have that kind of administration that lends itself to good bipartisan foreign policy.
Let me take you back to CPAC and vigorous debate. On the one hand, there was Governor Chris Christie, who talked about an inclusive party. On the other hand, there was Senator Ted Cruz, who talked about, you know, a different message. I mean, what's happening in terms of those two poles of the Republican Party?
They're within a big tent. That was my point in my speech in the Republican Party. We are not having disagreements with each other on principles or even policies. The disagreements that have occurred have been really over tactics. And so I think we should all put it in perspective. I call it the battle of ideas. It's creative tension. And I don't think there's really this vast civil war in the Republican Party that, like many on the left, like suggest there is. I think we're a party with a vibrant debate, adding ideas, solving problems. And I think we're going to be okay.
There's no better place to participate in a debate than to be a presidential candidate, as you know, because you've been a vice presidential nominee. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the question is, if you look at Iowa in a straw poll, 67% of the people said they want you to run for president. Do you want to run for president?
Well, I'm a friendly next-door neighbor in Wisconsin. So
yes.
What I think I ought to do is focus on my job here in Congress. Jana and I are going to sit down in 2015 and give it the serious conversation consideration that it requires. We're keeping our options open. But right now, I have responsibilities in the majority in the House of Representatives that I feel I ought to attend to, and then I'll worry about those things after this election.
Would you rather be Speaker of the House?
No, I've already kind of ruled that one out. I think there are other places that I'd rather be than that.
Thank
John
you,
Boehner's
sir.
Doing a fine job. Look, I know he's controversial, but he's doing a very, very good job.
Thank you very much, Congressman Paul Ryan. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us. We're back with retired Marine Corps General Jim Jones, who is a former NATO military commander in Europe and served as President Obama's national security advisor. Welcome.
Thank you, Charlie. Good to be
with you. So what should the president that you serve do now in Ukraine?
Well, I think a lot of the things that are happening on, between not only the United States bilaterally with Russia, but also the international community is pretty much what needs to be done. I think you don't want to knee-jerk and overreact.
What would you call knee-jerking and overreacting?
Well, a lot of the things that that we're talking about, you know, in terms of some of the tit-for-tat gestures that only tend to exacerbate the situation. This is a strategic question, I think, that has long-term strategic consequences, and it's more about economies and about the future of the region than it is about, you know, troop displacements right now.
Okay, I want to talk about economy, but one more question about force. I mean, is the United States and is NATO doing anything because of this crisis that's different from its normal rotation?
Well, NATO is not at the centerpiece of this, but NATO is participating along with the international community, with the UN, the EU, the OSCE, and doing the things that it can do and using the instruments that it has. For instance, the NATO-Ukraine Council, the NATO-Russia Council is in full gear. And they are doing things with regard to military exercises that are appropriate and not inflammatory. But they also, NATO needs to reassure its friends and allies to the east that we are one in this. 28 countries are one unit, and the United States is leading it.
What could cause this thing to fall, get out of control? So the one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, and all of a sudden we're looking at a hot, cold war.
I think precipitous moves that preclude people from being able to step back from it, and you get to the point where you get boxed in. I think this is a point right now where Mr. Putin has to understand that if he doesn't figure a way to get out of this, that the long-term consequences for him and for Russia could have serious consequences in terms of the economic relationships and the isolation of Russia with regard to Europe.
Put in the energy equation because of what impact that could have.
Well, you know, four countries, interestingly enough, yesterday, four countries sent letters to Speaker Boehner and I think the majority leader in the Senate. That's Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, and Slovakia, asking the United States to accelerate its shipments of energy to Eastern Europe in particular. This just underscores the fact that in a long-term and maybe even midterm scenario, our energy potential has the capacity of lowering the dependence of Europe on Russian energy, and therefore affecting the economic viability of Russia for a long term.
Is what's happening self-evidence of the fact that the Russian reset did not work?
Well, the Russian reset was predicated on the goodwill of the president of Russia and the president of the United States. And for the first couple of years, we had that. And there are elements of the reset that had they been allowed to continue, would have mitigated against what's happening right now. Unfortunately, a key player changed. We have a new president in Russia for whom the reset is not obviously as important.
General Jones, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back in a moment. Some of our stations are leaving us now, but for most of you, we'll be right back with a lot more Face the Nation. Don't worry. Welcome back to Face the Nation. I'm Charlie Rose. We're joined now by former Secretary of State James Baker, who joins us this morning from Saudi Arabia.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary.
Good morning, Charlie. How are you?
Good. Let me begin with President Obama and the way the United States is handling this crisis. What are your impressions of what the president has done so far?
Well, I don't have any substantial disagreement with the way the administration has been handling it so far, Charlie, although I will say this. I'm not sure that all of this would have happened had we, you know, stuck with our so-called red lines and that sort of thing. And so I sort of support the idea of moving carefully with this, moving prudently. This has all the potential of spinning out of control. It is clearly the most serious East-West confrontation since the end of the Cold War. And for someone who was the last U.S. Secretary of State during the Cold War, it's very disappointing to me to see that we're moving now from cooperation with Russia to confrontation again. That's very, very disappointing.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are very substantial. I mean, the risks are could involve more than just a small new Cold War, which I think we're pretty much in right now. I mean, I look at this as a Cold War light, and we don't need to go any further down that path. It could lead to some serious problems in the heart of Europe, and that would not be a good thing. So I'm very hopeful that that the president's message, President Obama's message, will get through to the Russian leadership. Sit down and talk with the Ukrainians. It's of course important that the Ukrainians understand that Russia has historical interests in Ukraine, and particularly in the Crimea, and particularly in their naval base there. But it seems to me that with a little bit of good faith on both sides, those kind of things can be worked out. Now, having said that, I don't think anybody knows what Russia's intentions are from here on out. Do they intend to try to take the eastern half of Ukraine? They've obviously said they're going to try and annex Crimea, even though that would be unconstitutional under Ukrainian law. Even though there are places in the Russian Federation who would dearly love to leave the Russian Federation, places like Dagestan and Chechnya.
When you say references to a red line, do you believe that Vladimir Putin thinks Barack Obama is weak and would not respond?
No, I don't. Well, I really don't believe that. If President Putin was privy to what went on in taking down Osama bin Laden, I don't see how he could think that he was weak. But I worry that he might feel that he's inconsistent. That we take a position here one day and the next day we do something else. I mean, we were going to bomb Syria and then the very next day, no, we're going to send it to the Congress for resolution. So all I'm saying is I support the idea of moving prudently here, moving carefully. There's a lot at stake. And I just don't think we can let the rhetoric get out in front of reality.
And do we have to give President Putin a way out?
Well, I think in a political problem like this, that's what diplomacy is all about, of course. Finding a way where both sides can walk away from the table and not feel totally shamed and humiliated. But guess what? There's not even a table yet. The Russians have been unwilling to sit down and talk with the Ukrainians. That was the number one request from President Obama. That was a very natural, normal, and proper request.
What does President Obama do if President Putin will not take the Russian troops out of Crimea?
Well, I think what the administration is saying to the Russians is, look, you ought to sit down and start a dialogue with Ukraine. You ought to let monitors from either the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or the UN come in there so the world can see what's actually going on. And then you ought to bring your troops back to their bases. Now, What do you do if they won't do that? Well, you know, we've already put on a few financial, I think, sanctions on some of the leadership that's responsible for the situation we're in today. There's a lot of other things, of course, that we can do. Broad-based political and economic sanctions. We could talk about moving some forces in NATO to the western border of Ukraine, so they would be there, but depending on what the Russian intentions are. Suppose the Russian intentions are to take the eastern half of Ukraine. That would be very, very damaging, and that could trigger one heck of a conflagration. So we need to have some troops on the ground in that eventuality. And I do think, too, Charlie, I worked with the Obama administration on the New START agreement, the New START nuclear arms treaty. And one of the things that was done at that time was for the United States to put on hold the idea of a missile defense system in Poland, the Czech Republic, and other places in Eastern Europe. You know, if this is the way the Russians are going to behave, there are things like that that we could do. And perhaps we ought to give some consideration to that.
There are those people who suggest that President Putin is a very smart strategist. There are others who say his intense nationalism overrules his rationality. What do you think?
I don't agree with that. I have met on several occasions with President Putin. I first met President Putin when he was an assistant to Anatoly Sobchak, who was the governor of St. Petersburg, or the mayor of St. Petersburg. And Sobchak was seen to be a reformer, supporting the idea of democracy and free markets, and Vladimir Putin worked for him. I don't think for one minute that he's not in control of his senses. I think he's very smart. He's very, very cagey. He is an ardent Russian nationalist. But, you know, you can be a Russian nationalist and still not take actions that are inconsistent with a stable world order.
What do you think of the fact that the president of Russia and the president of the United States are having these lengthy phone conversations? Is that the way to go, or should that be handled by secretaries of state and foreign ministers?
No, I think there's nothing at all wrong with that, because there's a lot at stake here. And there's, if we're going to finally get to a dialogue, if we're going to finally find a way to try and work out a diplomatic solution to this problem, I think it's very good for the leaders to be talking, not face-to-face, but talking to each other. And that doesn't foreclose the Secretary of State from talking with the Russian foreign minister. They're doing a lot of talking, too. And there's nothing that's good.
Who has the strongest hand at this moment?
Well, you know, the biggest, I think the burden of de-escalating here really has to fall on Russia, because it's Russia who sent troops into the Crimea. Now, they'll say they weren't Russian troops, but if you believe that, you believe in the tooth fairy. I mean, these troops were driving Russian vehicles with Russian plate armored vehicles with Russian military plates on them, and normally an indigenous militia doesn't drive around with armored vehicles with Russian military plates on them.
Any concern you have that while the focus is on Ukraine, in Syria, President Bashar al-Assad will take advantage of this on the ground?
Well, I don't know that this opens up an avenue for Bashar Assad to take advantage of it. I really don't. I mean, I think that as far as the United States is concerned and our allies are concerned, we can probably conduct foreign policy and chew gum at the same time. I don't think there's any problem with dealing with two different situations. I really don't think that.
Is your best guess that diplomacy will work?
Well, I would like to think that it could, because, you know, there's nothing in there. There's no good solution here. There's no good end game, and as far as I can see, for the Russian Federation here. I've already said to you that I think that the Ukrainian government needs to do some things, and one of those things is to recognize Russia's historical interest in the Crimea, particularly in eastern Ukraine, in their naval base. But those things can be done, and I think that that there almost has to be a diplomatic way out here, because continued escalation could very well lead to serious mistakes on the part of one side or another. And we don't need another shooting war in the heart of Europe.
Secretary Baker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie.
We'll be back in 1 minute. We're back with our panel. Rich Lowry is the editor of the National Review and also a Fox News contributor. Jeffrey Goldberg writes for Bloomberg View and The Atlantic. Peter Baker is the White House correspondent for The New York Times. And we're also joined by CBS News State Department correspondent Margaret Brennan. And I begin there. What's the latest?
Well, Charlie, Secretary Kerry spoke yesterday, the day before, with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. They're still not agreeing to sit down and talk directly to the Ukrainians. And that is where the bulk of the diplomatic efforts are being focused right now. Just talk to each other, whether it's directly or through an intermediary. So they believe that they're chipping away at this, but there's really been no change to the Russian position in terms of agreeing to sit down. We were in Paris on Thursday and on Wednesday with Secretary Kerry. I mean, Sergei Lavrov pretended not to even know who the Ukrainian foreign minister was, despite the fact he had arrived in the city on the Secretary of State's plane. So nothing's changing there. The facts on the ground have not changed, and we've actually seen these international monitors being blocked from going into Crimea.
And that was the point that Secretary Baker was trying to make in terms of talking to the Ukrainians. There is also Crimea right now.
Yeah.
Bob Gates, former Secretary of Defense, said Crimea is lost.
Yeah.
How does the administration see Crimea?
Well, look, their first priority since this has happened is to try to prevent it from spreading, right? They recognize that actually reversing Putin's hold over Crimea is not something that's going to happen in the immediate short term. That the first priority was preventing him from going on further into the rest of eastern Ukraine and creating basically a split country. Whether or not they can live with Crimea as sort of either an annexed part or an enclave is unclear, but that's what the Russian playbook has been before. They've done this in Georgia. They've done this in other parts of the former Soviet Union.
I would love to have been in on the phone conversations.
Yeah.
What are they saying to each other?
They've talked for, President Obama, President Putin have talked for an hour at a time, an hour and a half at a time. Some of that obviously is taken up by translation, so that cuts off the actual amount of conversation. But there's a lot of, I think, Putin talking about his grievances, trying to explain how he sees Crimea, how he sees the new Ukrainian government as illegitimate, a product of Western interference. And President Obama, I think, is pushing back on that, but trying to get him to agree to some sort of off-ramp. That's the phrase he uses, off-ramp. But, of course, President Putin is hitting the accelerator. He's not taking the off-ramp.
Is there any sense of how far the administration is prepared to go?
They tried to take it kind of slow at first. They put on some modest sanctions, not very many at this point, with the idea that they can point to the Russians and say, we're going to go much further if you don't reverse course. But there doesn't seem to be any sign that that's having an impact.
You've been writing about this. Tell me where you think the president has not done enough.
Yeah, well, I think the Russians would have gone into Crimea probably regardless. But when the president of the United States is not respected or feared around the world, it does create a more permissive environment. And I think some of the statements have been kind of otherworldly. John Kerry and others saying these are 19th and 20th century acts, as though the problem Putin has is he can't read the calendar correctly, and raw power politics is a thing of the past. Whereas if this stands, it will be the second time in 6 years that Russia has effectively changed international boundaries by force of arms. Now, I think some of the policy steps that the administration has taken the last week or so are in the right direction, but we need more and we need to persist.
More sanctions, more things like that, or more movement of troops, or what?
Sanctions, I think, are key, especially when it comes to the corrupt elite in Russia, and that's almost a redundancy. All these people in the government and people around them are very rich. They love to park their assets over here in the West because all of them need a so-called off-ramp, to coin a phrase, if things bounce the wrong way for them in Russia. So if you cut them off from here and, importantly, from Europe, which might be a little easier said than done, that will hurt.
Syria. Do you think this has had an impact in terms of Syria while the president is focused in with Russia and on Ukraine and not on trying to get something done in Syria?
Well, I mean, Syria is in a terrible spot, but I think there's actually a strange thing going on that people haven't noticed yet, which is that I sense that the administration is doing more now to help the rebels, especially on the southern front out of Jordan, than they previously were. Some of the statements coming out about Syria have been from more muscular. There's obviously been the director of national intelligence, who a couple of weeks ago talked about Syria as a direct national security threat to the United States. The deputy secretary of state has talked about this as a national security threat. I'm wondering if the president has been slowly dissuaded by the behavior of Assad, by the behavior of Khamenei, and the behavior now of Putin, into thinking that anything is discussable or that we can talk through any problem. And I'm wondering if we're moving into a phase that Jimmy Carter moved in after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, where he said, okay, enough with the belief that I can just reason with everyone. I don't know if we're there yet, but I think they're shifting in that direction a little bit.
Anybody think that's a possibility?
Well, you are seeing a more robust arming and effort in the south of Syria, but I think, broadly speaking, you know, the U.S. was embarrassed after that last round of peace talks that Russia just didn't deliver the regime in the way that, in many ways, they had estimated they'd be able to.
They fell behind the schedule.
They fell behind the schedule on the CW. They fell behind at the peace talks by, yes, they brought the Syrians to the table, but they didn't negotiate anything when they got there. And so I think that has led to a reevaluation of some of the policy. Politically, though, I think it is embarrassing and makes the administration sensitive to this public scrutiny that has erupted around Ukraine and this question of whether we should be reliant on the Russians in a diplomatic sense to deliver anything at this point.
The sense that I get, Charlie, real quick on this is that, you know, the president's always had a special carve-out for North Korea. The North Koreans are crazy. Everybody else I can deal with. I have a feeling, based on some conversations around the administration, that they're moving into a different understanding of Putin, not as crazy necessarily, but as a guy who can't be reasoned with, and that's going to have broad policy implications.
Reasoned with because he's obsessed by the idea of restoring Russia's grandeur?
Because in other words, just like the Iranians or the Syrians, they just have different goals, and the goals are not compatible, and they can't be worked out. Everything is about bringing everything to the table. Well, you know, there are two different tables at a certain point.
This, you know, George W. Bush didn't exactly have a cold-eyed, realistic view of Vladimir Putin right at the beginning, but all you needed to know happened in Georgia in 2008 when Russia invades. A little more ambiguous case than this one, but reset was about basically saying to the Russians, all is forgotten and forgiven over that, and let's work together. And we got really nothing of substance from it, because the Russians will help us, and this goes to Jeffrey's point, exactly to the extent it is in their own interest and no further. They're happy to have us fight Islamic radicals in Afghanistan because that's a common enemy. They're happy to forge a face-saving deal for the president over Syria's chemical weapons so long as they can further buttress that regime and help it crush its own people. With all due respect to Secretary Baker, they're happy to sign the New START nuclear treaty, which was a laughably bad deal for the United States.
The question of the Crimea is interesting, what's happening there today. And you hear Gates saying, Secretary Gates, that it's lost.
Right.
You have other people suggesting we've got to use more force, more pressure on Putin. What's the risk here of a renewed Cold War?
Well, I mean, we ought to be careful about overstating things, but I think obviously it's a risk of a very bad period of hostility. You heard William Hague, the British Foreign Secretary today, say that if Putin were to move into eastern Ukraine, that there would be a real chance of a real shooting conflict,
right.
He said, which is not
a
something
hot
you
war.
A real hot war, and it's hard to imagine, but it's certainly plausible these days. And it's important to remember that Ukraine is important to Russia in a way that we don't fully understand here. I mean, it's not just simply another country. This is part of Russia's history, its culture, its sense of identity, and we have to understand that.
And
in order
the diplomatic
to deal with
point is, how do you make them understand you understand that,
right?
And at the same time, serve your own interests that the Ukrainians should be able to decide their own future.
Right, exactly. Yeah. People in Crimea might actually want to be part of Russia, but can they do it at the point of a gun, in effect? Can you have a fair referendum with Russian troops there? That's a different
beast. And will the administration continue to be able to encourage the Ukrainians to hold their fire, essentially, right. and not be provoked. That has been a consistent message. Thank you for your restraint. This could be a lot worse. And I imagine that when the prime minister comes here to Washington this week, that's going to be a conversation again, how to prevent this from escalating.
Before we go down the road of, is this the new Cold War? I mean, it's important to remember, in the Cold War, there was a global competition between the United States. They were in Angola and Nicaragua and across the... Now we're talking about places that are Russian-majority, Russian-speaking, right up against Russia's border that we're competing about. So Putin is on the back foot still, and this is not about the global Russian empire.
This is not a power equality.
But I don't think anyone is really talking about threatening Russia's legitimate interest in Crimea. It already had some autonomy. No one was talking about kicking them out of that base there. So this is an entirely concocted neo-imperial play for power.
Well, it's a reaction to what he sees in Ukraine as being a threat. So he sees the new government coming in, tossing out Yanukovych as part of a Western conspiracy to move further. It's the next extension.
He believes the West had something to do with overthrowing Yanukovych.
Yes, and this is the extension of NATO expanding all the way to where they feel very hemmed in. They feel he is on the back foot in that sense, and he feels quite threatened as a result. There's also a domestic component. This is you know, politics at home. He's never been more popular since 2012 when he came back as president.
I think it's interesting here because we tend to brush aside the financial crisis there, but capitalism in so many ways is the administration's sharpest weapon and tool in this case, they believe, when dealing with Russia, when it comes to sanctions, or when they say, look what's happening to their markets right now, and they can't afford Ukraine to implode.
Interesting point, too. Jim Jones made a point about energy. I mean, we do have new weapons at our disposal to use, and if, in fact, they can rally the NATO countries, they have a better and more effective weapon, but people have expressed some misgivings about whether Germany is prepared to do that or not.
We're on a different page than Europe right now. That's the important thing, because they're tied into the Russian economy in a way that we're not.
We'll be right back. Stay with us. Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Jeffrey. Thank you, Margaret. Thank you, Peter. That's it for us. Bob Schieffer will be back next week. I'm Charlie Rose. Be sure to tune in tonight for the CBS Evening News and tomorrow for CBS This Morning for the latest on the missing Malaysian Airlines jet and the crisis in Ukraine. Thank you very much for watching Face the Nation.
This has been Face the Nation with CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Bob Schieffer. Substituting for Bob Schieffer, CBS This Morning co-host Charlie Rose. Today's guests were Dick Cheney, Congressman Paul Ryan, James Baker, and Jim Jones. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Rob Hendon, and the producer is Emily Bradley. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stockey-Wayne from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Google+, and Facebook.